The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house.
I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornado came through and got us. I'm buried under a bomb to roll my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 911, will put you in the dispatcher's chair, put you ear to ear with the callers and responders, and keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 911. Real 911 calls, real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I have a story for you today that is super creepy and awful and rough. Some of you enjoy that, some of you don't, so I'm going to have to balance between giving you the details but not being exploitive about it. This is the Wells Gray Park murders.
Have a very high tolerance for murder.
He is beyond saving. And I lost a piece of my heart that I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
Now, as soon as I said Wells Gray, some of you said, ah, yes, this one. But lots of you didn't, and you have no idea what I'm going to tell you today. So get a comfy blanket or your pet to cuddle with, because this is the stuff of horror movies. First of all, Canada has lots of provincial parks, and they are awe-inspiring in their beauty. And the story dates back to 1982, when I was 11. So I completely remember doing all the stuff and everything from back then. And one of the things my family did a lot when my sister and I were kids was going camping. And just about anywhere in BC is amazing for camping. The weather is great. The fishing is spot on. And just everywhere is beautiful. I was actually born in BC. So when I was quite little, we had a truck and a camper, one of those yellow and white Vanguard ones. And I used to just marvel at the little sink that it had in the camper that had that thin little faucet. I remember picturing myself living in a camper when I got older. When we would go camping, my dad always brought his fishing gear. We had those woven camping chairs that you can so easily get your little finger caught in when you close them up. And I believe we had an aluminum fishing boat that my dad would strap on top of the camper. And there was always hot dogs and chips and those stubby little brown bottles of beer for the grown-ups, which we always camped with some friends of my parents and their kids, or it was family of some kind. We always camped with other people, like my dad's cousins or something like that. If it was summer in Canada, you went camping. It's a thing. It's still a thing, only the trailers and campers have gotten a whole lot better. So Wells Gray Provincial Park is actually the fifth largest provincial park in British Columbia, and it is massive at 5,400 square kilometers, with mountains and lakes and rivers and trees and all kinds of stuff. So I can't imagine how much bigger the other four ones are. There's Clearwater River and then the Clearwater Lake, as well as about 8 mountains there. So lots to see and do, including hiking to like waterfalls. It's amazing and just crazy wonderful there. And there's actually a couple of ways that you can camp there. Like there's a lot of different campgrounds within the park. And some of it is what we refer to as front country park camping. So that's where there's actual campgrounds. Sometimes they might have a playground for your kids. You can rent kayaks, take some actual tours there. And sometimes they have access to shower facilities. It's like you pay a fee for the night and you rent an actual camping spot that comes with a place to build a fire, sometimes hookups for water if you're in a trailer or camper of some sort. And then there's also what we call backcountry camping, where you hike in somewhere remote, bring a tent, all your stuff with you, pretty much anywhere in Canada because it's so rugged. If you are going to go backcountry camping, you should know what you're doing in the wilderness. You should have bear spray with you and just kind of know stuff about, you don't have to be a survivalist, but you should know certain things about like where to poop and keeping your food from smelling up the place and attracting bears and cougars, that kind of thing. And the Johnson family was pretty much exactly like the way my family was. There was Dad Bob, who worked at Gorman Brothers Lumber. He was a funny guy, liked to joke, just your average, give you the shirt off his back kind of guy. Mom Jackie, a fun lady that was always just good for a cuddle with her own kids or her nieces and nephews. And then their two daughters, Janet, who was 13, she was bubbly and outdoorsy, and her sister Karen, who was 11, so the same age as me, more shy than her sister, but very outgoing within her own family. She sounds like she was exactly like me, very quiet outside the family, but I could talk my mom's ear off if I was given a chance. So exact same age as my sister and I, and doing the exact same thing in our family that our family did every summer. Probably much like your family too, if you're from around these parts. And the Johnsons' home was actually in West Kelowna in the Okanagan Valley, and Bob had arranged to take a couple weeks off work to do this camping trip. And they were going to be meeting Jackie's parents, George and Edith Bentley, who lived in Port Coquitlam. So on August 2nd, 1982, both families headed out from their respective homes. The Johnsons were in their beige-colored Plymouth Caravelle. It's basically one of those late 70s boat-style cars, very square. Four doors with a massive hood and a trunk. And they had a camping case on top of that, just like a Rubbermaid, large Rubbermaid container on top of the car. And the plan was that the grown-ups would sleep in George and Edith's new Vanguard camper, exactly like the one that my family had, that I remember vividly. And the girls then would be tenting it. And George was pretty excited because he had only recently purchased the 1981 red and silver Ford pickup truck that would be carrying the camper. And they also, just like we used to do, secured an aluminum fishing boat to the top of the trailer. So all of them were really excited about the trip. They were spotted heading up, I think it was Clearwater Road, towards this camping area. They stopped at one point just to get some quick specific directions to this camping area and were described as friendly and just all around normal, happy family, excited to be out and about. And of course, this was all before cell phones and YouTubes to sort of mess with anybody's family time or being pestered by work or whatnot. And from what I understand, they were doing a kind of a cross between backcountry and front country camping. So they weren't going super remote, but they weren't actually within an actual campground. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I don't think so. The area that they were in was about 75 kilometers north of Kamloops. And on August 16th, Bob didn't show up for his next scheduled shift after his vacation. Now, this wouldn't really be that much to be concerned about for like a normal guy, but Bob hadn't missed a day of work in his 20-year career, like not one day. His niece was interviewed by Global, and she said that he had once actually cut one of his fingers clear off at work and had come back to work the next day. So this was super unusual and worrisome. So the alarm bells kind of went off right away, and they started looking for them because, like, any number of things could have happened to them. They knew that the family had made it to the campsite. Edith had used a phone, like probably a payphone, to call her other daughter to tell them that they're enjoying themselves, and that was on August 6th. So Bob's boss gave Bob about a week to kind of figure himself out, show up. And then on August 23rd, he reported the family missing. And the ground and air searches focused on the Clearwater area where the family was known to have been headed, but they came up with nothing. Like six people just disappeared. So posters went up. Other family members came to help with the ground searches, but they weren't able to locate any of them or even their belongings. Then on September 13th, so a month after they should have been home, a mushroom picker called the police that he had spotted a burned out vehicle kind of hidden in some long grass and wondered if it could be related because it was a similar type of vehicle to the Plymouth that was kind of all over the news. The car was wedged between some trees on a sort of dirt road that wasn't really used by anyone near the foot of Battle Mountain. And the car was not just burned, but it was actually incinerated, like just kind of a mess of melted metal and glass. In the car's front and back seats were the very charred skeletal remains of four adults. They had all been shot in the head with a .22 caliber rifle. The keys were ominously dangling from the trunk, and when they opened it, the burnt skulls of two adolescents, there really wasn't much else left of either one of them. An accelerant of some sort had been used to essentially cremate the bodies and the car itself. Now, I don't know if you can just imagine what that means. It means that no matter what order the family had been killed in, you either watched your parents get killed or your child be killed in front of you. And I don't really care how quick that killing was. Those last seconds would have been a suffering that I just don't even want to imagine.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
A memorial service was held. All six of them were fit into a child-sized casket. I mean, if you can just imagine the visual of that for the remaining family. The next day, the RCMP managed to track what they felt had been the actual scene where the murders had taken place. About 20 kilometers away from the car was a place known as Old Bear Creek Prison Site, which I couldn't find a lot of information on. It was at one time an operational medium security prison, but the land had been sold off, and I think it closed down in 2001. So it was either being built at that time and just known as more of like a construction site, or it was fully operational, but that just doesn't sound right. It's strange that no one really reports more about that part. All I could really find was a description of what investigators found, which seems like this was the area that they were camping when someone evil had come along and killed them. They also found 22 caliber shell casings, some beer caps of the kind of beer that Bob was known to have drink, along with some full bottles that were laying in a nearby creek, which is something that campers often do to keep their beer cool. There was two roasting marshmallow sticks, like actual sticks that had been pointed into spears at the end, not the kind that you buy now that are like metal. The RCMP took out all the stops to find this, the truck and the camper that which was still missing. They figured find the truck, probably find the person or persons that did this horrible thing to three generations of a very innocent, close-knit family. Tracking dogs, helicopters, pretty much every single RCMP officer they could find were out looking for this truck and camper. Tips came in from everywhere across the country, including a false lead that the truck and camper had been seen in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, being driven around by two French-speaking guys leading the RCMP on a wild goose chase through Saskatchewan all the way to Quebec. Naturally, the murder of a family of six out camping was not only like very big national news here, but there was a lot of pressure to find the person responsible. But by the following spring, they still had not had any reliable tips and had not even located the truck or camper by that point. And then campers, of course, at Wells Gray had pretty much all dried up. Campgrounds in BC by April of 1983 were booked up in advance, which is completely normal. But Wells Gray, only 18 of the 105 campsites had actually been booked that season. So the RCMP went like tits in to do whatever they could to get creative on ways to sniff this guy out. And like they'd use the Crime Stoppers reenactments. Those were actually kind of new in the 1980s. But they also bought an exact replica of the truck and camper, including with the boat on top, and then drove it from BC through to Ontario and Quebec with like a bullhorn writing on the side that said, like, have you seen this vehicle? They also raised a reward for $7,500 for finding it. And hundreds of more tips flooded in. There's about 1,300 in total, but nothing solid. So another camping season kind of came and went without anything. And then on October 18th, 1983, two forest rangers spotted the truck and camper on Trophy Mountain, which was about 20 kilometers from the scene near that old Bear Creek prison site. Now, apparently the truck had been burned as well, but I can't confirm that. But the truck had been really close all along, this remote side roads that it took to get to the spot where it was. That showed the RCMP that the person responsible had likely been kind of under their noses this whole time and was from the area. Now, again, I can't confirm this, but it's some of the reporting said that the truck had been burned using an accelerant as well, which was probably gasoline mixed with something else. And the truck was really well hidden. It appeared that there had been an attempt to drive the truck into the gorge that was there, but logs had blocked its path. Now, one of the 1,300 tips that had come in had actually come in shortly after the murders had happened, but it hadn't been like necessarily followed up on. But it feels like a little bit like the investigators were working on the assumption that this guy was a complete monster. So he had to be transient, like he had to be from somewhere else because no one around there could have done something like this. So the truck was lifted from the mountain by helicopter and taken to the RCMP crime lab in a flatbed truck. And they told the media at the time that there were no clues or further evidence from the truck, but that wasn't entirely true. It wasn't a lie or a mistake. It was just a tidbit of holdback information that they held on to in case there was a tip that would kind of cover it. And there was a tip that proved useful, but I'm not actually sure when the tip was received. I feel like it was back early on, like close to the time of the murders. Anyways, a fairly local resident had been involved in a hit and run apparently sometime in 1980, and this particular guy had run over someone with their car and then took off without stopping or even seeing if the guy was alive or dead. Now, I don't think the particular tip came in about that. I think it was one of those sort of rumors around town that it might have been this guy. And the actual tip was about a guy that lived around the area that had asked the guy that was giving the tip how to re-register a Ford pickup and how to fix a bullet hole in the door. And that was odd enough of a request at the time that he called the cops about it. Now, despite the fact that the police had never revealed publicly that the truck did in fact have a bullet hole in it, no one kind of put two and two together on that until after the truck had been spotted and then realized that those back roads were actually really only navigatable by somebody that lived and knew the area really well. So, like, who is this guy? Well, he had come from a pretty good family. His dad had been a prison guard at the old Bear Creek prison when it was operating, and his brother was a sheriff. However, 23-year-old David Shearing, although a high school graduate and journeyman heavy-duty mechanic, had decided to forego the deep pockets that heavy-duty mechanic work would have provided him in favor of drinking and driving, assaulting people, and being arrested with drugs in his possession. He had lived in the Trophy Mountain area his whole life, but wasn't really known as a murderer. So locals were pretty shocked when on November 19th, 1983, he was arrested in Dawson Creek, where he was supposed to be appearing on, I think it was a possession of stolen property charge. Now, they actually didn't have a lot of evidence against him that it was him. They mostly wanted to bring him in for questioning and see if he would give up anything. And David, well, he thought he was being arrested for that nasty hit and run accident from a year before. And he had actually been one of the first people that had actually been interviewed by police at the time of the murders. And at that time, he even had a .22 caliber rifle that was hanging in his parents' house. But it wasn't taken in for any kind of evidence testing. They didn't even ask for a warrant to look at it, to check the casing shells against it. Inspector Vic Edwards, at the time of his arrest, said, "I don't have any right to go into your house and examine your guns, the same as I didn't have any right to go into Mr. Shearing's house. We had no reason to suspect him." So I guess we can put that in our pipes and smoke it. It was David's own friend Ross that had given the cops the tip that he had been drunk and ran over a man in Wells Gray Park Road back in 1980, which did unfortunately kill the man. But the accident was never reported for some reason, which I don't really understand that. So I guess he had gone down as like a missing person and had never been found. But I don't think to this day David Shearing has ever faced any charges for that man's death. So anyways, David went on into this questioning with Sergeant Mike Eastman, who is actually very important to the rest of the story, thinking that they were going to ask him about this hit and run. And so he readily confessed to that. But then they asked about this family of six. And he said, well, he had heard that had happened at Old Bear Creek, which had also was a detail that had never actually been released at that point. So he told them that he had spotted the adults sitting in their campfire. Well, here's what he says, actually, from the horse's mouth. "I walked out of the bush from behind the camper and started shooting. I put the bodies in the car, four in the back seat and the two little ones in the trunk. I poured gasoline. It just went whoof. I stood back and watched it burn. I went to the tent. I knelt down and I shot the other two." Now, he said he only wanted to rob them. Once he had shot all of them, he says that the girls were asleep in their tent when he shot them, so they didn't feel or hear a thing. He then put the bodies into the car and then drove into the woods, where he used a 5-gallon jug of gas to light it on fire and then cleaned up the campsite and drove the truck and camper behind his house and burnt it later when he realized it was too difficult to register and drive for himself. He then handed over his .22 caliber Remington rifle, which was matched as the murder weapon. Now, Sergeant Mike Eastman, he thought that this confession was all kind of a bunch of BS. He had a really hard time believing that an entire family would be killed over a truck, and there had to be more to this little tale that he's weaving. But the confession was enough to at least take to trial. But Eastman told Shearing one day after the trial that he was going to get the whole truth out of him. And in April of 1984, he pled guilty to 6 counts of second-degree murder and was sentenced to life imprisonment with no parole for 25 years. Now, that whole 25-year thing has gone back and forth, but at that time and now still, it is the longest that somebody can wallow in prison here before they can ask for parole. They can ask. It doesn't necessarily mean they'll get it.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
And when handing down the sentence, Justice Harry McKay said, "What we have, very simply, is a cold-blooded and senseless execution of 6 defenseless and innocent victims for no apparent reason. The sentence I impose in conjunction with such matters as protection of the public and specific deterrence must have proper regard for public opinion and must express in clear terms the revulsion felt by the great majority of our citizens for this senseless and vicious mass killing. This case is at the upper range of culpability. The victims were unknown to the prisoner. They did not in any way provoke him. He knew they were camped at the site and carefully scouted the situation. He went home and returned either that night or the next with a loaded 22 rifle. Why? We do not really know, but it seems like it was to rob and to kill. There are no ameliorating or mitigating factors. The enormity of the crimes demanded the maximum sentence." Now, William Shearing, who's David's dad, had passed away from cancer in March of 1982, so just about 6 months before this murder spree. But his mom, Rose, said, "I hope it's a bad mistake or a bad dream. He's always been such a good boy. He's always worked hard, and he always saw that I had everything." His brother Greg said, "I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask the police too. I have a hard time believing all this, and I can't really say anything right now because it wouldn't be fair to Dave." Well, fair or not, prison is where David Shearing went, and he did not appeal his sentence. And Mike Eastman was determined to get this whole truth from him. So he headed to Bowdoin Prison to re-interview him, saying to him, "You know why I'm here, David. I think you sexually abused those girls before you killed them. You told me some time ago that you would consider telling me the rest of the story after you were sentenced. Well, I'm here to collect, David, and I'm not taking no for an answer." And so David revealed the horrifying truth of exactly what had transpired that early August of 1982 at Wells Gray. David had seen the families pull into the campsite that they had picked, and he watched them set up their camp, like he watched them concealed in the woods for a couple of days, which is super creepy. He had spotted 13-year-old Janet and was having dark and disgusting thoughts about her. So when the sun was setting on August 10th, six days before Bob was expected back at work, he came out from the bushes holding his rifle and shot Bob first, then Jackie, before shooting George and then Edith. Like, one shot each was all it took. He then poked his head into the tent where he knew that Janet and Karen were already in their pajamas. They were getting ready to crawl into their sleeping bags, and told the girls that there was a biker gang in the area and that her parents had run off to get help. So just stay in the tent so you don't get hurt. So the girls huddled down, like terrified out of their minds, not even aware of what is yet to come for them. So David took the opportunity to drag Bob, Jackie, George, and Edith to the Plymouth, covered their bodies with blankets, and then crawled into the tent with these terrified girls, where none of us should even try to imagine the unspeakable things that he did to them. David said, quote, "I saw them just as a means to an end. I saw the 4 adults basically as being in the way of what I wanted at the time. It was just Janet as far as I was thinking, and Karen just happened to be there." Oh, but it gets worse, much, much worse. So David took the girls, now defiled and probably pretty sure their parents and grandparents were dead, and they were probably soon to follow, to a fishing cabin out on Clearwater River that his parents had, where he continued to rape and torture them, until one day when a prison guard showed up at the door to tell him that he was supervising some prisoners that were fishing out along the river. Yeah, because that makes sense that prisoners should have some leisure fishing time. Like, really. Anyways, David made the girls hide behind the door and not say a word. No, the girls obliged, of course. They were terrified. So David loaded the girls then into his truck and then moved them out to his family's farm. And at one point he hit Karen and she started to cry, of course. And he says, quote, "At that point, I lost the excitement that I had felt. I wasn't able to continue any further in the sadistic part of it. And on August 16th, the day that Bob was expected at work, David walked Karen out to the woods, told her to turn around so that he could have a pee," like he suddenly had some modesty about him. "Now, I have no idea what was going through Janet's mind when he returned without her sister. But the next day on the 17th, he did the same thing to her. And he loaded both girls' bodies into the trunk of the Plymouth where he had hidden it with some bushes and then set it on fire." Now, this second, more terrifying version of his story was fact-checked. RCMP went out to the fishing cabin, saw that the initials JJ had been carved into one of the walls next to his own initials. Many of the items that David said that he had stolen from this truck and camper and the car that he thought were maybe valuable were recovered still at his parents' ranch house. And then the prison guard was tracked down that remembered the meeting, but he had not noticed anything out of the ordinary at that time. And so David Shearing was 24 at the time that he was sent to think about what he did and hopefully suffer painfully in prison. He sat for a few years. Now, don't panic. Spoiler alert. He's still there. And David, sometime between 1985 and 1995, changed his name to David Ennis, which was his mom's maiden name. And then in 1995, he got married. Yes, you heard that right. To a woman named Heather from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, that he had met in 1993. She said, "I have seen so much change in this man since we met. I know the man's heart is in the right place, and I'm just here to back him up." Gross. And under the faint hope clause that was alive and well back in 1999, he applied for early parole after serving only 15 years. The faint hope clause was for prisoners that were serving long sentences, basically giving them a chance to get out while they were still alive. It has since been shut down and no longer applicable to anyone. Now, Mike Easton, he about lost his mind at that and said publicly, "If people don't pay attention, he's going to get out." So to keep people remembering what he did, he wrote a book about the case. It's called The Seventh Shadow. And he released it as kind of a please don't give him parole plea to the public to raise some awareness about this case. Quote, "I was in the RCMP for 35 years, and for 35 years I had to keep my mouth shut. This was one of the worst crimes in Canadian history. To me, Shearing's no different than Clifford Olson or Charles Manson. He's never shown one indication of remorse. He's one of the big guys in the big house because he's a murderer and he's having a good time there." Now, his parole bid was denied. He came up for parole again in 2008 when he was 49, and the parole board wasn't impressed that he still hadn't admitted to his having these violent sexual fantasies, which is kind of weird that he'd be allowed conjugal visits with Heather for years up to that point, and he still hadn't completed his own sex offender treatment plan. Even stranger that Heather would even want any conjugal visits with this guy or anything to do with him. In 2012, he was denied parole again. Now, that bid came with 13,258 signatures on a petition against his release. Bob's younger brother said, "I just hope the petition makes a difference. What he did was so terrible. What in the world is wrong with this man? And what did he do to those two little girls? That's the part that tears you apart." In 2014, he applied, but then he withdrew his application a month before the hearing after discovering that an even bigger petition was out there now at this point with 15,000 signatures. And as the years went on, his family home was bulldozed and new homes went up in its place. At some point, David wrote a letter to his friend Ross, the one that had turned him in the tip about him, asking if like the townsfolk in Clearwater still hated him and Like, the guy, Ross never answered the letter, but he would have had to tell him, yeah, buddy, they still do. Now, he stayed quiet for a few years before applying for parole again in September of 2021, so just 3 years ago, at the age of 61, now balding and fat. This time he admitted to the parole board that he had had sexual fantasies of a disgusting nature since he was about 15. Quote, I thought it was normal for a man to think that way. He also admitted that because no one knew about the sexual nature of his crimes, that he had actually been treated like a celebrity in prison for, like, killing six people. That was nothing. Quote, they thought that was okay. Molesting two girls, they would have killed me. My biggest fear was having people find out that I was having problems sexually because it made me feel like less of a man. My crime was an enormous, brutal, and inexcusable tragedy, resulting in tremendous loss to the community that I can never make up for. It makes me hate to be in my own skin. I do apologize to all, especially to the victims, for the impact that it has had on them. Yeah, we hate you in your skin, too. It was the first time in 25 years, though, that he had offered any kind of apology or remorse. Janet and Karen's cousins said to the media outside, don't listen to anything he says. He has no remorse. It's like looking at the devil. He's a waste of a body. During victim impact statements, which are normally allowed at parole hearings, thankfully, Jessica Lehman, who's a relative, said, it's more than a horror movie now. He is a monster in the woods. We fear for our lives. We fear he will kill again. He used it to destroy my family. He doesn't deserve a second chance. So petitions at this point have now reached about 100,000 signatures. Tammy Arishnikov, who initiated the online petition, said six people died because he wanted them dead. He is still the same sick, brutal, callous, remorseless monster that he was in 1982. He showed no mercy for my friend. Now, despite his apology and that he'd been going to a sex offender treatment program and spending time working at the prison chapel and taking a course at the Prairie Bible College, he was once again rejected for his bid for parole. There are overwhelming negative aspects in your case, the gravity and severity of your offending. It's of the utmost level. It was very violent and devastated so many people. When we look at your assessed risks together with your diagnosis of sexual sadism, which largely remains unchanged, the most appropriate place for you to make gains is in the safety and security of the institution. So David Shearing, or Ennis, or whatever you want to call him, he is still at the Bowdoin Institution just south of Red Deer, where every Canadian, except Heather, hopes that he will remain until he takes his last breath of air. And that was the horrible murder of the Bentley and Johnson families. And I'm going to be back again next week with another episode for you. In the meantime, if you want to do your rate, review, subscribe, follow, whatever it is, as always, thank you so much for listening.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live Expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice.